So I want to welcome back to the stage, ladies and gentlemen, this is Colleen Edwards. A fixture at the University of Oxford. He's not only professor of Tarkovian neuroscience, he is also head of the Nuffield Laboratory of Ophthalmology and the director of Oxford Sleep and Circadian Neuroscience Institute. So I just want to give a big warm weekend welcome to Mr. Professor Russell Foster.
Natural rhythms. Who are those? And they dictate the best time for a range of activities in our calendar. That's fine. I have to say I was less comfortable with 10 a.m. Have a bikini wax. Or an injection. Or a visit. Basically anything with an ouch factor. And you tend to see that it's lowest between 8 a.m. and 10 a.m. It's not entirely clear why, but it's probably because the pain receptors are not later in the day. Now, I promise you, I didn't say that. And I certainly didn't say 6:30 p.m. herald the start of 2.5 hours of sex and drinking. If you're going to be at the dinner tonight, then you know why. Is some truly remarkable, amazing biology. So every aspect of our physiology and behaviour, and you can see a whole range of parameters here, mood, body temperature, melatonin, stress hormones, sleep, are changing profoundly over the 24-hour day. And they change because they provide us with an adaptive advantage, coping with the various demands of activity and rest. So we'll see in a moment, hormones rise and fall, so that they can fine-tune that physiology and behaviour to the varying demands of the activity, the rest activity, sleep cycle. Now the key thing is that the 24-hour changes that we're going to be talking about continue under constant conditions. So if you or I were to go to a deep dark cave, constant light, constant temperature, they would still persist. They'd be a little bit longer than 24 hours, but we'd still see these rhythms. And the key thing, of course, is because they're not exactly 24 hours, they need to be adjusted every day. And it's the exposure to the daily light-dark cycle that means that the internal time, the internal biology, and the external world are perfectly aligned. And of course, the classic mismatch is jet lag, when internal time and the external world are not matched. And we'll talk about some of the consequences of that in a moment. Okay, so let's look at four different areas where we can talk about some detail relating to these changes that we see in our physiology and behaviour. And the first is core body temperature. You see this graph here, 2 o'clock in the afternoon to 2 o'clock in the afternoon, say it's a 24-hour day, and we see there's a big drop in core body temperature. And in fact, this drop in temperature is critical to allow sleep to start. If you stop that drop in core body temperature, it's much more difficult to get off to sleep. And then we see, in anticipation of activity, the clock starts to generate a rise in core body temperature, increasing our activity, increasing our metabolic rate, in anticipation of the changed world of activity and when they need to be active. Now this change, this dynamic change, as I said, is important to sleep initiation, but if you're an athlete, it has a really important impact. Don't you have any athletes in the audience? Hand up. Excellent. Any swimmers in the audience? Okay, well let's talk about whether you agree with this later on. There's some great studies on swimmers, and you can see that in the early hours of the day, swimming performance is slow, but as the day proceeds and you get to late afternoon, early evening, it speeds up hugely. And what's really extraordinary is that over a relatively short distance of 100 metres, you can swim 100 metres 2.7 seconds faster in the late afternoon, early evening than your training sessions in the morning. Now that doesn't sound like a lot, but of course it's an Olympic athlete. That's the difference between coming first and then falling embarrassing last. So athletic performance is hugely affected by this internal clock. Let's go to something perhaps a bit more serious, which is blood pressure. Systolic blood pressure, 120, 130, 140, ideally. But it shows a big drop. Again, it's dropping in anticipation of sleep. And then you have a really sharp rise in anticipation of activity in the morning. And that rising blood pressure has big implications, not least on stroke. Everybody, I guess, knows what stroke is. You get this build-up of debris in the vasculature. The blood pressure rises in the morning. The clots get dislodged. They lodge into the vasculature of the brain, and then you have a stroke. But look at the timing. This is some work by my colleague Peter Rockwell, and you see time of day along here. And the frequency, the number of strokes on this axis here. And look at this huge great peak, which corresponds to that rise in blood pressure. In fact, there's a 49% greater chance of having a stroke between 6 a.m. and 12 noon than at any other time of the day. And that kind of information is really important in the way that we time our medications. We should be taking our anti-stroke medication, ideally here, before that great surge and that great vulnerability in having a stroke. I should say, overall, there's about a 29% chance of dying naturally between 6 a.m. and 12 noon. So, about when I'm finishing my talk, you look at the watch and it's like, you're still alive, you can see it. Alertness. I think we all assume that we may not be on our most alert for the 4, 5, 6 o'clock in the morning, but I want to show you some data which gives us a sense of how really impaired and how unable to function we are in that early hour of the morning. This is a study, not by us, but these people here, Lamont and Dawson, who looked at the drop in alertness in response to alcohol and then time of day. And what you see in this graph here is that here's a drop in alertness. And on this axis, it's an increase in alcohol consumption, blood alcohol here. And I know it's a huge surprise to many of you, as I've observed over the past few nights, that increasing alcohol, your cognitive abilities and your alertness drops. But the point I want to make is that about this value here, this is when you're legally drunk in the UK, you have a drop of, let's say, minus 15. The details are important. Let's now look at the same tests, but done over the 24-hour day. And there can be a bit of a dip in the middle of the afternoon, but after around about 10 o'clock, our cognition drops hugely. But look at this. In the sort of dangerous window of the early hours of the morning, our ability to function, our alertness, is worse than this cup of wine here is when you're legally drunk. So if you take nothing from this lecture at all, that if you're driving a car in those early hours of the morning, your ability to drive that car is as bad as if you've got into the car a few whiskeys or a few beers inside you. So be aware of that. And of course, that explains why that time of the day is when most accidents are most likely to have a car accident. Okay, let's now go on to the fourth of those big examples of our 24-hour biology, which is sleep. Very straightforward. 36% of our entire lives will be spent asleep. A huge, prestigious amount of time, prodigious amount of time. And if you compare it to everything else, whether it's general activities, work-related activities, watching TV, I was intrigued by 8% of household work. I have to say my household is very near 8% of our time. But this is, in terms of time spent, sleeping is the most important behaviour that we exhibit. And yet, we largely ignore it. We marginalise it completely. Give you an example of what I mean by this 36% of our time. When you celebrate your 60th wedding anniversary, now, is anybody here celebrating the 60th wedding anniversary by any chance? Any hands? Yep. Not yet, okay. But when you do, bear in mind that of those 60 years, 21 and a half years are actually asleep. Which means, actually, you can't really take credit for that. Is that the quality of those 38 and a half years that you'll spend with your partner will be so much so dependent upon those 21 and a half years of
sleep.
That's a really good condition. Okay. The other thing I wanted to make in these early signs was the way that we used to think about sleep in the pre-industrial era. This, of course, is William Shakespeare. And if you read the plays and his sonnets, there are endless allusions and discussions of sleep. I just thought I'd draw your attention to these wonderful words. Enjoy the honey-heavy dew of summer. Absolutely. O sleep, O gentle sleep, nature's soft nurse. How I frighten. Just beautiful words. They embrace sleep without even understanding the neuroscience of it. And Thomas Dekker, a contemporary of Shakespeare, said, and I think because it's extraordinary, you know, from the 1600s. Stephen, the golden chain that ties health and our bodies together. And yet, when we jump forward to the 19th and the 20th century, we've abandoned the high-headed thumb. Here's a remarkable individual, a genius, Thomas Edison, and the invention and the distribution of cheap electric light allowed us to invade the night and develop our modern industrialized systems. And I think I'm asking a good thing. But of course, sleep has been associated, and in the process, we've marginalized the importance of sleep. Edison got many things right, but the statement, sleep is a criminal waste of time and heritage for our caregivers, is one of the things that's gone wrong. And I'm now going to go on to the next topic, which is essentially to look at that criminal waste of time, which is the neuroscience of sleep. Okay. So let's just think about what's going on during sleep. So many people, and for years in a sense, we thought of sleep as an inactive time, where nothing was really going on. In fact, during sleep, some of the areas of the brain are even more active during the wake state. And critical, essential features of our biology are going on during sleep. So if you want to lay down memory, then during sleep is one of the critical times of memorizing information that's been flooding in during the day. And it's not just laying down memory, it's also manipulating that information. Information processing goes on at night. So if you want to come with an innovative solution to a complex problem, then a night of sleep has been shown to be enormously beneficial of your ability to come up with innovation and to deal with awkward problems and come with solutions. In addition, you've got the clearance of toxins from the body. You've got tissue repair. Growth hormone is critical for tissue repair. It's only released at night. That's where much of the tissue repair is going on. The rebuilding of metabolic pathways that allow optimal function during the day. Again, critical at night, and indeed energy replacement. So all this essential stuff is going on, which we've largely marginalized and have not been taken into serious consideration. Now, because of the amount of time we spend asleep, and because of the complex processes that are going on, no great surprise that sleep arises from multiple brain structures, from the ancient brain, the hindbrain, and the hypothalamus, all the way through, and of course, the cortex. And it draws from all the key brain neurotransmitters. So histamine, for example, is one of those neurotransmitters that keeps us awake. If you take the drowsy antihistamines, that's why you fall asleep, or you feel drowsy, because they're interfering with this pathway here. So, you've got this great complexity, we'll come back to that later, but that's just the circuitry within the brain. In addition, you have a large number of important drivers and modulators of sleep. The one that we're all aware of course, is social timing. So much of our life is dictated by the alarm clock, forcing a sleep-wake pattern upon our biology. We're driving biology outside of where it's comfortable much of the time. We'll look at some of the consequences of that. There's another really important biological process called sleep pressure. And it's the intuitive part about sleep. The longer you've been awake, the greater the need for the sleep of the sleep and the greater the pressure to fall asleep. And that's been associated with the build-up of substances in the brain like adenosine. Now, why is that interesting? Well, it explains why caffeine keeps us awake. Caffeine interferes with the action of sleep pressure with adenosine. And so you feel far less sleepy after a cup of coffee because you're interacting with these pathways here. Then, of course, you have the biggie, the biological clock, essentially imposing temporal structure on everything we do. Now is the appropriate time to be awake, now is the appropriate time to be awake. And so it's sending that message to all of those key brain structures. You know what the biological clock is. There's been, I think, one of the great triumphs in neuroscience over the last 20 years has been misunderstanding. And if we look into the brain, we flip the brain upside down, and you can see the eyes going into the optic nerves, going into the brain. If I take a section across here, for those people just over here, you see this beautiful little structure right at the base of the brain, 50,000 cells, and that is the origin of this data. That is the master biological clock. We know how it works. So the yellow dot, you see our individual cells. If I take one of those little cells out and stick it in a dish, it will show a 24-hour or near 24-hour oscillation in its behavior. Individual cells act as individual clocks. And so what we've got in that extraordinary bit of the brain is 50,000 individual clock cells, all coupled, all ticking away to generate this master biological clock, providing that internal day that's regulating so much of our biology and our physiology. Now, what we thought, and until very recently, we thought we understood all this. The master biological clock sent out a signal and imposed 24-hour rhythms on the rest of our biology, our muscles, our hormones, or whatever. But now we know that every cell in the body has its own little clock. So what's happening is that this master clock is then regulating, coordinating the activity of billions and billions of individual clock cells throughout the body. It's a remarkable observation, a remarkable discovery. It's even more stunning when you think that the same basic machinery that generates a day within, in us, is the same in a mouse, and indeed even in insects. Much of our early understanding of how this clock starts to tick is because of the work on insects. So, this is an embedded, ancient part of our biology. Okay, so we've talked about the clock, the social timing, we've talked about sleep pressure, the biological clock. None of this is of any use at all unless the internal day and the external day are aligned. We've already talked about this. The eye protects the light, our cycle, and sets the clock. But the eye is also doing other things as well. It's projecting to those areas of the brain that increase levels of alertness. We've all experienced this. You go into an environment and the light levels, even like now, are dim. You feel tired and sleepy. If I were able to reduce the amount of light, you'd feel so much more alert and so much more interested in what I was saying. And there's another little loop that we meant to talk about, which is the pineal gland and the production of melatonin. There's a lot of hoo-ha about melatonin. Melatonin is important, but it's not the sleep hormone. You can get by without melatonin. And maybe the girls dinner tonight, we can talk about what melatonin is actually doing. It's essentially a biological marker of the dark, and it's probably feeding back on the master clock to give us some additional stability. Okay, so the point I want to make in this section is we've got immense complexity. Multiple brain structures, multiple neurotransmitters, we've got social timing, we've got the eye, we've got the master clock. And this complexity makes sleep very vulnerable to going wrong. Very vulnerable to disruption. And when we disrupt sleep, we have a big impact on our overall health, on our cognitive health, the ability of the brain to process information, and indeed on our emotional and mental health. And as you guys will also be aware, all of these three critical elements of our health are intimately linked. And that's what I want to consider next. Let's now look at the impact of sleep disruption on our biology. And let's just also touch briefly on gender. Okay. So we said overall health, cognitive health, emotional and mental health. What do I mean? I mean in terms of overall health, the things. We can have a suppressed immune system. We are more vulnerable to cancers. There's cardiovascular disease and diabetes too. And I'll talk some more about this in a moment. In terms of our cognitive health, our memory, our creativity, our ability to spend time attending to the environment, and indeed, microsleep, this catastrophic means to simply fall asleep, which many people have at their time. And then finally, of course, mood instability. I was talking to somebody backstage, and I won't name who they were, but they were saying, well, sleep deprivation, the mood is swinging all over the place, high sleep demand, anxiety, the dependence upon stimulants and sedatives, and indeed impulsivity to do stupid things without reflecting on it. All consequences of sleep disruption. Let's look, first of all, at some really good examples of inattention and mindlessness. In the United States, 100,000 crashes into England every year are related to sleepiness. The Exxon Valdez in 1989, everybody thinks it was because the captain was drunk. Yes, he was asleep in his cabin. And what you had was an inexperienced, chronically tired individual trying to drive that boat. The accident investigators determined that fatigue was a key factor in the crash, and the Exxon shipping company was criticised for failing to supply a rescue crew. The tragic crash of the Air India Express in 2010. The accident investigators said the pilot could be heard snoring on the cockpit version of the shortly before this landing, which killed so many individuals. And perhaps the most catastrophic of all was in 1986, Chernobyl. This is a bunch of people in the middle of the night shift, chronically tired, jogging around saying, I wonder what happens if we do. And of course, the International Nuclear Safety Group determined that human error related to sleep deprivation was an absolutely key factor in this catastrophic disaster that affected so much of Eastern Europe, and indeed Western Europe as well. Okay, this is a wonderful thing that somebody said to me. And this was tips for married ship workers. And this is on a notice board at work. And somebody had scribbled underneath, don't go shipwreck. I'm not stupid enough to say we've got to put the 24/7 GE back in this bottle, but what we can do and what we must do is be aware of the health consequences and cognitive problems that we associate that are derived from shipwreck. So we need to be sensitized and aware of what's going on. Let's look at what the brain is doing. In a fully rested state, this is the brain doing mathematical tasks. You can see all of the areas lighting up in this rested brain while this person performed mathematical tasks. The same person was then signified for a relatively short period of time. And now look at the areas of the brain that are lighting up. A little spot there was absolutely extraordinary. Brilliant illustration of how the brain is intended, how it does not function. It doesn't get the right amount of sleep. We've talked about the cognitive consequences of that, Exxon Valdez, Chernobyl. But also, one of the other consequences is that tired brains like this do the following, which is a tired brain after it's been woken up by the alarm clock, and of course many of you are getting up before 7 o'clock, it will reach out for stimulus. So the second thing your brain will instruct you to do is probably have a cup. Caffeine, lots of caffeine, it pushes back that sleep pressure, it really does help. If it's a very naughty tired brain, it'll go for nicotine in cigarettes, and I can't believe I've seen some of you guys out there smoking cigarettes. You know who you are. And there can be, of course, additional stimulants, which we can talk about again tonight. It's going to be a long time. So caffeine, for example, can last up to 9 hours. So if you start drinking coffee, and strong coffee, in the afternoon, it will delay sleep at night. And so the day is often fueled by people taking more and more caffeine in to stay awake, to do the job, to give them the alertness they have failed to have as a result of getting a good night's sleep. And so it's getting late, they think, my God, what am I going to do? I'm going to get up. I know what I can do. I can take sleeping tablets or alcohol. And of course, these are extremely effective sedatives. But the key thing, ladies and gentlemen, I want to convince you of is that these are sedatives. They do not provide a biological mimic of sleep. And in fact, we know that they can interfere with some of those vital processes going on in the brain during sleep. For example, memory consolidation is enormously inhibited by alcohol. So this terrible stimulant-sensitive feedback loop, and I have to say that I've been seeing a lot of people, at least in the front row, nodding vigorously, implying that this is a description of their lives. There's somebody here saying, absolutely not, brilliant. But we tend to think of adults doing this, but the most chilling thing that I experienced recently was it was at a school in Liverpool, and I spoke to a 13-year-old young lady, and I said, what's your sleep like? And she said, fantastic. And I said, wonderful. How are you managing it? Because most of your friends here tell me they have terrible sleep. They're going to bed late, they're getting up tired, all the rest of it. So what's your trick? And she said, it was simple, I just take my mother's sleeping tablets. 13-year-old child. So I then said, okay, how are you managing the next day? She said, it's not great, but after about 3 Red Bulls, I can sleep. And the very, very serious issue here is here's a young person, her brain is still developing, it's still forming all those essential connections that's going to make her what she is. And and yet it's being interfered with these stimulants and sedatives. And frankly, we've got no idea what the consequences of that will be. But what's always more terrifying is that we're not giving our young people any advice about the importance of sleep and why good sleep is such an essential part of their biology. We can hardly blame them for behaving like this if they don't know what the consequences are. Appetite, profoundly affected by disrupted sleep. There are two really important hormones. There's ghrelin, which is released from the gut, enters the brain, and it basically makes the brain get hungry. It has a craving for carbohydrates, and particularly for sugars. And it predisposes to weight gain. And it's sort of counteracted by the hormone leptin, again released from the gut, which is the brain, and it's a satiation hormone. It makes us feel less hungry. And normally there's sort of a balance between leptin and ghrelin. And incidentally, this is me before. Sleep disruption hugely pushes the seesaw towards the release of ghrelin. After 7 days of relatively restricted sleep, you can elevate levels of ghrelin by 28%. That will lead to an increase in carbohydrate consumption of 35 to 40%. And those individuals, and this is an experiment by Edna Captain, the University of Chicago, and she went on to show that those young, healthy males, their ability to clear glucose from the circulation was bordering on the diabetic. So here's a really important bit of data showing that sleep disruption has a big effect upon the metabolic axis, not least susceptibility to diabetes too. If we also think about stress, short-term stress is great. It allows us to survive, to either fight or to run away. And it's been critical. However, the problem with sleep disruption is it turns the stress axis on for long periods of time. It sustains stress that causes the problems. Those problems are, you're throwing glucose out into the circulation, the liver is releasing glucose, and of course, you are reducing the metabolism of that glucose by not releasing so much insulin, you become glucose intolerant, metabolic syndrome, and again, predisposes you for diabetes too. Classic case of sleep disruption is gastric acid secretion and ulcers. So many of sleep-deprived individuals have gastric ulcers. Immunity. The one thing we know about cortisol, the high levels of cortisol, is that it suppresses the immune system. This makes individuals, and this is some great data from night shift workers, far more susceptible to infection, and indeed some studies from Denmark have shown that night shift, long-term night shift nurses have a higher rate of colorectal cancer and breast cancer. And we think it's via this suppression of the immune system as a result. Blood pressure. You're pumping more blood pressure, more blood around, blood pressure rises. And what we also know is that in night shift workers, those other individuals who are sleep deprived show significant levels of cardiovascular disease. And finally, cortisol can impair memory formation and brain processing. So, really big and important thing that they're screwing up in terms of sleep disruption. But I just thought I'd touch very briefly on jet lag. So why do you feel so ghastly if you're flying from one across multiple time zones? Actually, the London to Florida trip is relatively easy. But what's happening in my body now is that my alertness, my melatonin, my growth hormone, my body temperature, and my digestion, and my muscles are all slightly out of alignment. It's not simply that the whole body is shifted 5 hours from London to Florida time. It's the fact that internal biology is a smear. It's internal desynchronization. Why is that? We don't know. Because, of course, all these individual cellular clocks throughout the body, when you fly across multiple time zones, become uncoupled from each other. So they're all all of these organ systems are lacking synchrony. But it's exposure to the new light dark cycle. And after about a day for every time that you've crossed, you'll ultimately bring back internal order once more. Okay, so let's now move to the eye and the importance of light. Just to remind you, The eye protects the light, dark side. It sends a signal to the master clock. And we see here a beautiful cartoon of rhythmic sleep wake. Here's when the person was awake, and this is when they're asleep, day after day after day after day. Now, if you damage that bit of the brain with the master clock, then the ability to regulate those 24-hour rhythms is gone completely, and you end up with completely non-24-hour behavior. In fact, we studied an individual, in fact, the husband of a good friend of mine, who had an anterior tumor in his brain, and he knew he would die, the family could be done, so he said, study it, and we did, to the point of death. And as the tumor spread through the hypothalamus and destroyed this part of the brain, he went from a 24-hour pattern to this pattern. It was a very remarkable thing that he did. If you have no eyes, however, then the clock keeps on ticking, but remember I said it's a bit longer in us. So we can go to bed a bit later and later and later each day. So it drifts through time. And indeed, everything then becomes asynchronous. It will come as fast as that. So the eye is critical, providing us with our signal to regulate the clock. But if you think about it, we're asking the eye to perform two main different tasks. And the function of the eye, of course, is as an image detector, to give us a sense of our world in terms of images. But we're also asking the eye to detect brightness, and the amount of brightness in the environment over a period of time, and to use this information to regulate the clock, so the clock knows what time it is. These are really different functions, and I could not understand, when I got into this business about 20 years ago, how the visual system we've been studying for 150 years could also give rise to this other brightness detection system. So we looked again at the eye, and just to familiarise yourself, here's the visual cells in the eye, the rods and cones. This is sort of the inner part of the retina where there's lots of image processing going on. And then these are the ganglion cells, which form the optic nerve, take all the information into the brain. And we wondered whether there could be another light sensor within the eye, very different from these classical visual cells. And so the experiments we did over almost 15 years was to study humans and mice with genetic defects in the eye, whereby their visual cells had degenerated and they were visually blind. And we then asked, well, what's the impact of this loss of visual cells on the clock? And the experiment was, if there was another class of light sensor in the eye, then you'd see a beautiful alignment of rest activity in the light dark side. But if there wasn't another cell, then the clock would just drift through time, irrespective of the fact it was exposed to the light dark side. And the most extraordinary and exciting thing for us was this result. In the absence of the visual cells, you could still regulate your clock perfectly normally. When it was in the eyes, as if you count up the eyes, then this facility had gone. There had to be something undiscovered and new in the eye that was detecting this light for internal regulation of the clock. So what is it? If it's not the rods and cones, what is it? We discovered that, in fact, it's one of the ganglion cells. So those cells that form the optic nerve, about 1 in every 100, is directly light sensitive. And it's grabbing brightness information from the environment to tell the clock and sleep systems what time of day it is. Now we, of course, have these ganglion cells, and they're most sensitive to this part of the spectrum. So when you look at that screen now, I know that your photosensitive retinal ganglion cells are really getting excited. And what's of course interesting is that this blue is the blue of a perfect blue sky. So they're tuned to the maximum available light in the environment to provide light information. I couldn't resist just showing you what one of these cells look like. They are exquisite, beautiful little things. And what they do is form a great net, here they are, across the eye, grabbing light into the regulation of internal time. The point I want to talk to you about then is that there's a difference. Visual blindness does not result in the loss of all light protection by the eye. Yet, sleep and 24-hour rhythms and their abnormalities are completely ignored in clinical ophthalmology. Ophthalmologists consider vision, they don't consider this other function in the eye. So I'm deeply lucky to work with my colleagues in the Optive Eye Hospital, and we're addressing a bunch of questions, which is, what's the impact of ocular disease, eye disease, on human sleep-wake biology? And I won't show you the data, but I'll show you the sorts of things that are coming out. So there are patients, of course, who have genetic defects and they'll lose their visual cells. But they still have left these light-sensitive ganglion cells. They can still regulate their biological clock, even though they have no sense of vision. And yet, these people ignore it. Essentially what happens is that the consultant will say, I'm sorry, you're blind, there's nothing more I can do for you, that's it. And what they should be told, of course, is to still expose themselves to sufficient daytime light to allow their clock to be regulated by the light outside. But that information is not embedded in any physical department across the world. It gets worse because there has been a tendency to say, look, you're blind. Your eyes have no use for you. You're probably going to Down syndrome. They're a source of infection. Let's just remove them. Let's just get them out of the way. They're going to be a couple of diseases, and that can be so much simpler. But of course, completely avoiding what's happened is that somebody is then being deprived of the potential of their sense of time. And of course, in the same way, there will be genetic defects, where the rods and cones are perfectly fine, but the inner retina, including the ganglion cells, would have been lost. But all is not lost in those individuals. They can be given drugs which can stabilize, they can mimic the effect of light on the clock, and then give them some sort of temporal order. So the point I'm trying to make is that clinical ophthalmology and the rest of us must appreciate that the eyes are absolutely critical. They not only provide us with our sense of space, but also our sense of time. And light is infinitely important in providing that signal. So if we look at the light intensity range in Florida, for example, on a cloudy moonlit day, a dim light going up to a bright light of 100,000 lux, we can read perfectly well with 1 lux. Most of our office lighting and our home lighting is in the 100 to 600 lux range. But to robustly regulate the clock, we need brighter light. We need light in the 1,000 to 2,000 lux range. And actually, many of us don't get it. In fact, we live in dim, dark spaces. The light at the window, well, may well be 4,000 or 5,000 lux. By the time you get to the door here, it's dropped to less than 100 lux. So bright light, whether it's artificial or natural, is a critical aspect of our bodily health. Okay, let's now finish with the last topic. I won't be long. And mental illness. Craven, the father of psychiatry, said back in the 1880s that abnormal sleep patterns and mental health are linked. Clearly, explicitly stated, completely forgotten for 100 years. In the 1970s, with the development of antipsychotics, people said that bad sleep we see in mental health is due to the antipsychotics. Forget it. That people have been talking about bad sleep in mental health for 100 years before any antipsychotic use. If it wasn't antipsychotics, then abnormal sleep and mental illness such as schizophrenia was just misdiagnosed. These individuals don't have a job. And this is a quote which has got on the internet. This psychiatrist said to me in an elevator, my patients can't hold down a job, so they wanted to get up late. This might turn into the don't friends. Complete disregard for the nature of sleep disruption in mental illness. And so we decided to look at it. How bad is sleep disruption and circadian rhythms in patients with schizophrenia? I just want to show you some of the extraordinary results. You can measure sleep wake very easily with a little wristwatch type device which measures activity. You can see here midnight, and this is where the individual started to sleep and when they woke up. And you see that we can also collect urine and collect hormone levels as well. So we knew where the clock was. So this is a stable sleep wake pattern. You see, this individual is getting up, going to bed from an after midnight. You see that pattern reproduced again here. This is the range of sleep wake that we saw in patients with schizophrenia. It is one of the most horrifying things I've ever seen. This is the best person to see. You see so much of the activity that's carrying on at midnight. And this individual here, you see patterns of 24-hour REM activity. That's completely and utterly falling apart. This is huge. I've never seen anything like this in any other group. And it was observations like this, and our increasing understanding of the neuroscience of sleep, that allowed us to come up with a new way of thinking about this problem. We suggested that sleep disruption and mental illness share common and overlapping pathways in the brain. So if you have a problem in the brain pathway that predisposes you to mental illness, you're almost certainly going to have an effect on the sleep. Now clearly, the sleep disruption may make the mental illness worse, potentially, and mental illness may of course affect the sleep disruption. But the origins of this extraordinary observation of massive sleep disruption and mental illness is because of common leaking pathways in the brain. And this led to a bunch of specific predictions. I'll go through them very quickly. Which is that essentially the genes linked to mental illness might also affect sleep, and the sound of a bunch of them are. And indeed, genes that have been linked to sleep also have been leaking out to mental illness. So there's a real overlap here between the mechanisms that give rise to normal sleep and the mechanisms that give rise to normal habits. But a really more interesting prediction was, okay, well, if the mental illness is not giving rise to the sleep disruption, then perhaps we'll start to see sleep disruption prior to any clinical diagnosis of mental illness. And so with my colleague in Oxford, particularly, we've been looking for whether sleep disruption precedes a clinical diagnosis of mental illness. And we studied kids at risk of bipolar. So you can assess pretty well those kids who are at low risk versus those who are high risk of developing bipolar. Here's the low risk example, nice rest activity profile, no activity across the night. Again, you can see it here. This is a kid who is at high risk. And you see already the sleep wake pattern is beginning to break down. This is now characteristic of those kids who are high risk of developing bipolar. Why is it important? Because what it provides potentially is a biomarker, an additional way of predicting those individuals who are vulnerable to developing mental illness. And if you can have an early diagnosis, you have the chance of early intervention and perhaps changing the trajectory of that condition. And the final bit of the data I'd like to talk about is, okay, what about this? If you can stabilize sleep, will you have a positive outcome on the mental illness? So do you see a reduction of sleep disruption? Will it improve the mental health condition? And I will finish with this slide. This is from my colleague Dan Freeman here in Oxford. So what we've got on this axis here is the levels of insomnia, sleep disruption, so levels of insomnia. And this is prior to treatment, the stabilizing sleep, and this is afterwards. And so you can see he's halved the level of insomnia in these patients with schizophrenia. That's great, you can do it. What's the outcome of that? So this is the baseline levels of paranoid delusion in this individual with this level of insomnia. The key question was, when you can start to stabilize insomnia, do you reduce the levels of delusion paranoid? That's what he's able to show. This is extraordinary. So what we've got is a marked attenuation of the delusion paranoid in these individuals. Not by giving them drugs that are antipsychotic, but by simply tackling the sweet problems. So, what we've got, I think, is some really exciting new emerging data. By studying mental illness and sleep disruption in parallel, we're beginning to find fundamental mechanisms that link these two critical elements of human health and performance. We also know that sleep disruption is a very powerful biomarker of impending mental health problems. And we know intuitively that in depression, a change in the pattern of sleep precedes the depressive illness. We've known that for some considerable time. And then finally, perhaps most excitingly, we can think of new therapeutics. We can think of the sleep systems as being a new target, a new therapeutic target. If we can stabilize sleep, we have a chance of pulling back individuals from that crisis of mental illness and indeed having a big chance of improving their overall health. I should add that in severe mental illness, the life expectancy for individuals is 25 years lower than people without severe mental illness, and that's extremely successful. Okay, I've run out of time, but I wanted to just sort of come back and go over all the stuff that I've told you in the past 4 or 5 minutes. I want to give you a sense of the world of 25 rhythms and the fact that we have an internal day which is fine-tuning every aspect of our physiology and behaviour to the very demands of our respective cycle. And you really will. And it's extraordinary how we treat sleep today. It's an illness that needs a cure. Actually, it's part of our fundamental biology that needs to be addressed. One of the great success stories of brain science has been an increased understanding of the neuroscience of sleep. And by understanding fundamental mechanisms, we can begin to think of what's going wrong in these situations where life sleep is falling apart. We can actually think about evidence-based intervention. Sleep disruption is much more than just the inconvenience of not being able to sleep at the required time. It's cognitive presence, which you're all aware of. Now we know it's associated with a whole range of health problems. And we're talking about big stuff. We're talking diabetes 2, we're talking immune suppression, we're talking cancer. And then, remarkably, asking fundamental basic questions about how is light interacting with the biological clock, we've discovered a completely new way of thinking about the eye. We've redefined blindness. And that information could potentially affect 500 million people worldwide who have severe eye disease. They should be able to get the right results. And then finally, an emerging area whereby there's an overlap in those pathways in the brain giving rise to normal mental health and those giving rise to sleep. And I think the most exciting thing to me is that if we can stabilize sleep in patients with mental health problems, we can certainly improve their quality of life. Maybe even, as Dan Freeman has been able to show, drag them back from the severe edge of the pathology that these crippling diseases have caused to humanity. And with that, I should finish. Thank you very much.